We're going to bring the meeting to order because we have quorum. You know, it's all about how you get quorum. It's not how you maintain quorum around here. I want to thank everybody. Representative Fritz, why don't you come up so we can get you to your committee meeting. And you have to forgive us. I just want you to know, normally our folks, when, you know, I was teasing McNurtney and saying if we were doing an informational hearing, the members would have been here probably on time, but now that we're doing a couple bills today, we're moving a little slower than normal. It's been a long week, though. Extremely long week. But good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members.
How are you this morning, Representative Fritz?
Well, thank you.
Let's see, Representative Reinhardt, you want to move this bill for Representative Fritz?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 3147 be passed and referred. That's all right. Be passed and referred to Health and Human Services Policy.
Thank you. Good morning. Go ahead.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I do have one change, an oral amendment, if I might.
Yes.
First, line 1.9, in cross off emergency medical transport and put Minnesota Ambulance Association.
Members, you have that on 1.9, delete emergency medical transport and replace it with Minnesota Ambulance Association.
Correct.
Okay, we will have Representative Fritz incorporate that oral amendment into her bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This division has heard about the problem of so many people with mental illness ending up in the juvenile justice or criminal justice system. People usually end up there because their behaviors, which are symptoms of their illness, create an emergency. Until recently, the only help that could be obtained was by calling 911. Then typically, police, although sometimes fire and emergency medical personnel, would come out. Over the past few years, crisis services have been developed across the state. These services are critically important if we are to develop a mental health response instead of a criminal justice response to a mental health crisis. These could include mobile crisis teams, hotlines, walk-in crisis programs, or residential crisis services. The Consensus Project, which is the premier report from the Council on State Governments on how to decriminalize mental illness, points out the importance of providing a user-friendly entry to the mental health system. To me, this meant that it should be easy to access crisis services. Right now, however, it is very difficult to know how to reach them and to know what they can do and how they can help. House File 3147 will create a task force with all the stakeholders and those knowledgeable about these issues to determine if it is feasible to create one number in the state to respond to mental health crisis. With me today to speak in support of this bill, to my right is Sue Abderholden from NAMI, and I'm going to turn it over to her for next. And then we have a parent, Dan Parnell, and we have from the Ambulance Association, Nick Alpin. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abderholden with NAMI, Minnesota. As Representative Fritz mentioned, you know, we now are starting to get crisis services. Last year, as part of the Mental Health Initiative that you passed, you actually had a lot of funding to go to crisis services around the state. So we're really, in many ways, kind of at the beginning of creating a full-blown crisis system in Minnesota. So we think it makes sense to now, before everyone gets too embedded in advertising their phone numbers, to really look at, can we create one system? I printed out the list of mental health crisis services from the state of Minnesota's website. Now, you're a parent. You're feeling like things are getting a little tough, and you look at Freeborn County. There are five numbers under Freeborn County for different types of crisis services. You can imagine it would be pretty difficult to figure out, you know, who to call, where to go, what would be the most appropriate service. If you think about someone crossing county lines, even in the metro area, well, gee, then who do you call? What's the number in Hennepin County, even if you really knew the number in Ramsey County or vice versa? I think it's time to really take advantage of one number. I have no idea how the 911 service works. That's why we, you know, created the task force with, you know, kind of different folks, folks who know the mental health crisis service side, folks who know the 911 emergency response side, and together we can figure out if, in fact, we can do this, and how, and if we can, how much it would cost. We think it just makes sense. I'd like to introduce Dan Parnell, who is a parent who would like to share his story.
Good morning, Mr. Cornell. Please identify yourself to speak for the tape.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dan Parnell, and I live in Matamidi in Washington County. Among my four children, I have a 19-year-old son who has a diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder. Raul's issues include a co-occurring chemical addiction manifested primarily, but not exclusively, in marijuana and alcohol use. The drugs he uses inhibit the effectiveness of prescription medications that he takes to manage visual and audio hallucinations and mood instabilities that are always with him. Raul's prescriptions have changed often in trying to find medications that are most effective for the symptoms he has exhibited at any given time since they began to emerge about 4 years ago. During that time, I've become a volunteer and advocate in the field of mental illness in the interest of learning as much as I can about this disease and our systems of care. I've done this as any parent might, to be a support to my son and to best understand how our health system and services can help him where he is incapable. Although he is special to me, this young man is like so many people who have this disorder. The experiences that I've had in attempting to help my son's growth and strive toward recovery are unique only in the details. They have included a number of mental health crises that included raw nerve, fear, indecision, and concerns for the immediate physical safety of my son or someone else in the family or the community. These moments of crisis are ones that magnify all of the negative aspects of the mental illness and test any who responds to use their best skills and judgment. Most often they are beyond the abilities of well-meaning parents, close friends, and even increasingly tragically, the best efforts of police officers. It's hard to recall now how I've responded to each crisis, but many have included a hurried call to a crisis line individual who is desk-bound and unwilling or unable to respond physically, certainly not in the time frame needed by the demand. I remember it was always troublesome to determine what crisis number to call based upon the day of the week, the time of the day, whether it involved him as a child or as an adult. Ultimately, many, if not most, if not all of these situations resulted in calls to the police to locate Raul out in the community or to assist in transporting him to a hospital. My history with crisis includes threats that my son would end his life, threats that he would harm others, and situations where I feared that his lack of ability to make rational judgments would harm or could result in him being jailed or restrained, or in the attempt that he would escalate police response to reactions that I'm afraid to even consider. Again, I consider these experiences to be pretty typical after countless discussions with many other families. A simple example story with a healthy dose of irony occurred 1 month ago yesterday and encapsulates what it is to be in this situation. Raul has lived in a group home for about a year to foster his independence and living skills while enabling our relationship to grow into something other than one characterized by restrictions and authoritarian rule. In recent months, he had abused a small stipend he received, and we had agreed that after an allotment for him, we would withhold some of this money to make sure that it would not be used to purchase drugs. On that day 1 month ago, I had taken the day off of work to attend the Minnesota Mental Health Innovations Conference. One of the sessions of particular interest to me was the presentation by Roger Meyer, who is the coordinator of Metro Mobile Crisis Services. Roger included in discussion his hope for the use of a single phone number that could be used as a first call for help during a mental health crisis. At the conclusion of the session, I found that I had two voicemail messages easily recognizable to me as the resident line and the business line of the group home where my son lives. Sensing distress, I listened to them immediately. The first was my son, agitated to the point of expletives, in his displeasure that the money we agreed he would not receive without prior discussion was not made immediately available to him. His threats included harm to himself, and his mood was psychotic. The other message was from the manager of the group home, who gave me her perspective on the event, and including her sense of fear for her own personal safety and for his at the time, and disruption and fear that occurred to other residents. My son had stormed out in anger, and no one had any idea where he was found. I had just come from a session related to crisis management, but the reality was that the system was not prepared to deal with the situation that confronted me. If I were to call the crisis number, I would reach people who may completely understand what was needed, but they would be, as I was, unable to react fully. If I were to call police, I would reach people who could react promptly, but without the needed context, and in fact, their presence could result in further escalation of problems. This is the challenge every family faces in a crisis. What is needed is a crisis intervention team that would respond to incidents such as this one, a team that is trained and available. What is needed is for that team to be available at whatever telephone number is used for an emergency, be it 911 or a different number like 811. What is needed is for law enforcement, 911 operators, and families in crisis to be able to reach that crisis team fluidly and seamlessly so that the number isn't important except in that triage can determine when to switch the call there. A mental health emergency could occur on a crowded highway in a place where police jurisdiction is questionable and from a random caller who has no knowledge of any specific mental illness crisis line. Medical emergencies happen every day, and we're able to respond with prompt medical care. We need the same response to answer the needs of those with mental illness emergencies. I'm not naive enough to think this can happen immediately. There's probably not the structure to do so within the system today. But we need to pull together those who understand how crisis services are provided around the state, from a variety of law enforcement and public service agencies, and from those who understand how 911 works. Together, these people should be able to figure out how we can accomplish an easier way to access mental health crisis services. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Parnell.
Madam Chair, members, I'll be quick. Buck McAlpin, President, Minnesota Anvil Association. We're very supportive of this bill. Over this last fall, we worked with the Anvil Association, the EMS State Regulatory Board, the NAMI folks, and about 40 different members to address some of the EMS issues with transferring and caring for mental health patients. And just to give you a quick number, from 05 to 06, our inter-facility hospital transports of mental health patients went up 25%. And so we're about 1,200 runs from the year before. And these are very, very long-distance inter-facility transports we're doing. And in some of the areas of the state that have worked on these crisis-type systems, we've noticed a decrease in access to mental health interfacility transfers. We're very supportive and would enjoy working with these folks on moving forward in a program like this.
Thank you. Representative Fritz?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I certainly appreciate you hearing this today, and I think that from the testimony, I hope that you see the need, and hopefully we can bring folks together to find the solution for these folks. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want. Do other states have this already, so that we can look and see how it works, or are we the first?
Representative Fritz.
So Minnesota will be the first again. Another leader.
Nothing wrong with that, Representative Wardlow.
No, I'm always looking for an easy way out, though. It's kind of, you know, good to copy someone if it works, you know. Can I have one more?
Yes, of course, Representative Wardlow.
Thank you. Is there going to be a cost to anyone to set up this task force? I understand the need to study it, but I just wonder, can these costs be absorbed?
Ms. Adler-Holden or someone from the department, maybe?
We have made the department very aware of this. We said, of course, that we would help as much as we could. I've not heard any objection from them, so I'm going to assume that they are going to absorb it.
Don't be saying that word. Okay.
I'll bring the
Miss Andrew Holden, you were doing so good up until that last couple words.
Madam Chair, I've spent probably 20 hours a week since you adjourned last year at task forces that they put together, so I figure fair is fair.
Wow, I like that. Representative Warlow, did that get you where you were going?
It's no different than some other answers I've heard in different places.
It works.
I just had one curiosity. Have you heard from 911 responders where, I mean, you know, sometimes 911 is appropriate if bodily harm is imminent for someone, but sometimes a mental health crisis might not raise to the level of violence, but it raises the level of you got to get help. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's something you're just going to study. I was wondering how many, what's the ratio of absolute 911 to a little less than 911?
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, actually up in the Grand Rapids area, they have worked very closely together with their mental health crisis teams, their ambulance service, and their 911 operators, and they're actually triaging those calls. It's one of the, when we heard what they were doing up there, we really realized that maybe this was something that could go statewide, and they're the ones that have had the serious reduction in the number of interfacility transports and just long distances, and they've actually reduced their hospitalizations up there by quite a bit as well.
Representative Wardlow?
Aha. There is something to copy. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Fritz, I didn't get a chance to talk to you about this because while you were having your testimony, it just popped in my head. And so I had Ms. Aves put together a sentence that I'd like to incorporate into your amendment, if you don't mind. And I'm just making sure that we have someone from culturally competent organizations included in this. And so I'd like to insert, after the comma, or line 110, after families, comma, members, huh?
After the period?
Is it after the period? Oh, no, excuse me. Nope, it's a new sentence. Please forgive me. After the period, advocates, members of the work group shall represent I'm sorry, members, because you know what? Man, I did change my thought. Please forgive me, because initially when Ms. Aves did this sentence, initially it was just going to say members of the work group still represent culturally diverse populations, and I changed that word, and so I don't think it fits anymore, because I changed the last word populations to organizations, and so wondering if it would be easier, does it still work? Okay, so it is, sorry, members of the work group shall we represent culturally diverse organizations.
Mm-hmm. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I recommend a friendly amendment and instead of saying represent, include?
Yes. Friendly amendment. So members, the sentence is going to say, members of the work group shall include culturally diverse organizations. Are there any questions? Representative Britt?
I do. I like that addition. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you mind incorporating that into your bill?
I'd like to incorporate that.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or concerns members have? Seeing none, Representative Reinhart renews her motion that House File 3147 be recommended to pass and re-refer back to Health and Human Service Policy. As amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Fritz.
The bill is
approved.
Thank you very much, Representative.
It's passed.
Walker and members, thank you.
Yes, you may. Representative Cohen, as one of our non-Metro folks who was here, you had plenty of time to look at the minutes. Representative Cohen, do you mind moving our minutes?
Madam Chairman, I move approval of the amendments for February 29th.
Thank you, Representative Cohen. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. Members, I just want to do a couple of things, and I'll have our Ms. McNerney send out something to the rest of the committee, giving you an idea of my intention moving forward, especially after talking to Representative Hosh last night. We are going to have a hearing next week that will cover a couple of things, especially fetal alcohol syndrome disorder. It is my intention to have one or two other hearings sometime in the very near future, and respecting the time that members have this summer and fall, we will not be doing that. Well, I'll have plenty of time. But respecting the time that you all will have doing other things this summer and fall, my intention is to do it during session, but also being respectful to our members that are out of the metro area and don't have an opportunity to spend time with their families during the week. We are going to try to find a different time to do those two additional hearings. But we will be meeting next Friday. And just to let you know, two of the things that I want to make sure that we cover, we did not have an opportunity to have the department come back and talk about some of the questions with their implementation, especially with Representative Madora's questions. In addition to that, I have not forgot about Representative Rood and Representative Wardlow. Last year requesting that we do something around post-traumatic stress disorder. And so it is my intention to focus on that and doing something as it relates to our returning vets, our refugee community, and then also me being from South Minneapolis and the amount of youth violence and how that is impacting our young people. So there are a couple other topics that we may touch on, but I want to make sure that we do those two things before we do finish session this year. Okay. Thank you. Representative Reinhardt.
Representative Walker, would you like to move House File 3377?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do move that, please. And I do believe I want to move it. She recommended to be referred back to Health and Human Service Policy.
All right. And Representative Walker, would you like to introduce the bill?
Members, I am going to let the department start on the overview. This is a Department of Human Services bill. I'm carrying three of them, and I do need to move an amendment. I'm not quite sure how I can pick the three. I would like to also, if possible, to get it in the way that I'd like the bill to be shaped, move the A1 amendment.
All right. Representative Walker moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape she'd like it to be. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. The amendment is approved. Speak to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Walker, my name is Glennis Edwall. I am the Director of the Children's Mental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Appreciate Representative Walker's carrying this bill, and I'll provide a little brief background and overview. On May 26, 2006, 7-year-old Angelica Arndt died in a Minneapolis hospital. Angelica was being treated in a day treatment program in Rice Lake, Wisconsin, where she was restrained face down the previous day. The coroner determined the cause of death to be chest asphyxia. Clinic records showed that she had been held face down by two clinic workers on 9 different occasions in the months that she attended the day treatment program. At the time of Angelica's death, Wisconsin's Mental Health Act allowed the use of restraint in emergency situations or when the restraint was part of a treatment program. Questions were immediately raised about the legal status of restraint and a corresponding procedure known as seclusion,
in Minnesota health care programs for children. In Minnesota, the use of restraint in both inpatient hospital programs and in residential treatment facilities is strictly regulated, with each program required to be certified in its use. But day treatment programs, an intense level of community-based treatment corresponding to the level of treatment in which Angelica was restrained, were not covered by these statute and rules. Since that time, DHS has worked with representatives of provider groups and advocacy organizations to determine a course for correcting the situation. In the 2007 session, attempts were made to integrate a solution with licensing requirements, but that approach proved both cumbersome and potentially expensive. Further, Minnesota providers were already moving in the direction of curtailing or eliminating use of restrictive procedures and seclusion, including being trained in de-escalation techniques which reduce the likelihood of need for any more invasive procedures. The major provider group affected by any change indicated that it welcomed policy clarification on the issue, and advocacy groups indicated that the most important first step was a mechanism for monitoring use of the procedures to determine what training or other steps might be needed, and hence House File 3377. Very briefly, just let me review. The scope of House File 3377 covers intensive service providers who are cover less than a residential or inpatient level of care. The definitions come from the Children's Mental Health Act and include all of those who might serve children who are having very serious functional difficulties, having their treatment needs met without being in a somewhat more contained situation. The most typical is day treatment, and is certainly the focus for this legislation. But given that the same children may be seen also in other intensive forms of care in the community, all of the definitions that are at that more intensive level of care are covered here. The most basic thing that this legislation requires is that each agency have a plan for when restrictive procedures and seclusion might be used that very clearly specifies when, under what conditions that will happen, and that all other means that will keep a situation from escalating or that could deal with it without this level of intervention are in place and have been tried. Oversight must be maintained by a mental health professional in the agency. Parental consent at the time of enrollment in a program, so that parents are well aware that such procedures are planned for, and then immediate parental notification if a procedure is used is included. Training for all providers is an important component of this bill and is specified in the bill. An administrative review must take place within the agency for each action that is taken, as well as periodically. And then finally, an annual report to the commissioner is required, with oversight then provided by the Children's Mental Health Division to follow up on any outlying providers who are using more such procedures than would be considered reasonable. I have with me Mary Reagan, who is Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, and also Sue Abderholden from NAMI, who has been instrumental in working with us on this legislation, to respond as well as me to your questions.
Members, are there any questions for Ms. Edwall or any of her other potential testifiers here? Any comments or questions? Representative Hash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to give the other testifiers a chance, but I'm not sure if we're all trying to get out of here early or not, but I'd be fine with that, too. One of the things when looking at this legislation within the definitions of who is required to report, planning and procedures for restraints, one of our areas that deal with a lot of youth are our schools. And how would this apply to schools, or is that a different criteria in which we should also have some oversight over?
Ms. Edwell.
We have discussed that question extensively, particularly with NAMI, and I'm wondering if Sue Abderholden would be willing to respond to that question.
If you would introduce yourself.
Madam Chair,
you.
Sue Abderholden with Minnesota. Madam Chair, Representative Haas. The schools are actually governed by the special education rules, which were drafted, and we're waiting to hear back from the administrative law judge on them.
Unfortunately, their standards, frankly, are much lower. Plus, they allow mechanical restraints and even manual restraints. And so they are very different from what we'd be requiring from the community providers. We would like to, frankly, in the future, not this session, but maybe next year once the rules are final, actually look at making a community-wide standard, whether it's in a school or a residential facility or a community mental health program, so that there's consistency across the board. As you can imagine, there are some mental health programs in schools, for example, day treatment programs. And so a child could be in a classroom, on one hand, governed by different rules and being treated differently for the same behavior, move to the day treatment program, and then be under these rules and not be able to allow to use those, you know, those procedures. I realize that, you know, we view these as kind of different settings, but what we have learned, both in Minnesota and across the country, is that you can actually learn other techniques to deal with these behaviors that work very, very effectively, and we don't have to resort to them if you get the right training. And again, I always worry, I mean, you know, there was the one death there. I have a whole list of other deaths from across the country, including in schools, where kids were restrained and became asphyxiated and died. And I think that's the kind of thing, any death of a child is tragic, but when it could be prevented, I think it's particularly tragic.
Representative Hush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that's something we should look at into the future. I mean, I understand that, you know, to put more mandates on our schools is a very touchy subject and something that we should be concerned about. However, if there's a way that we can isolate or focus on, you know, the settings in which there are day treatment centers in schools already, I think that gives some credence to also having to apply the same standards as what the day treatment centers would have to do. If we're going to serve those populations in the same setting, they should be governed under the same rules.
To follow up on your point, Representative Hush, I'd like to ask Ms. Aberholzen if you have begun any discussion with the special education professionals or any of the educational community, because having been on a school board for 12 years, I know that this issue has been discussed from a variety of angles.
Madam Chair, to be honest, we're kind of waiting for the special education rules to be, you know, released to see what they, you know, we produced many, many pages of comments on this issue. We're kind of waiting to see what the final rules are. And then I have talked with a few of the education organizations to say, depending on what comes out in the rules, we'd like to meet with you to see if there's some other way to get kind of the community standard on this particular issue. But that's why we're not pursuing anything this session, but you might see us back again next year.
Well, thank you, Ms. Aberholzen. I would just encourage you as much as possible to include the educational community in this discussion so that, you know, they're aware of what's occurring, and I think it'll undoubtedly make the next steps, you know, more constructive. Are there any other questions from members for any of our testifiers? Yes, Representative Walker. Yes, an oral, okay, Representative Walker would like to propose an oral amendment.
On page 10. I'd like to strike after the period after the statute, the section, on line 1012, the rest of the line, and to strike lines 13 and 14.
It sounds like this amendment came just from our current discussion. We are not at the level for...
Madam Chair, it's actually an email that Ms. McNerney had to remind me about while you guys were having that conversation that I was supposed to do at the beginning.
All right, well...
the bill.
So, Representative Walker has moved an oral amendment to the bill to strike 1012, starting at after the period through 1014. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Okay. The amendment passes, and we're back to the discussion of the bill as amended. Do members have any other questions or concerns? Okay. If not, Representative Walker would like to renew her motion to pass House File 3377 as amended and forward it to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The bill is passed. Thank you very much. This certainly is an issue of great gravity, and I'm I'm happy to see that we're moving forward in a constructive manner. So, our next bill is House File 3576. It's Representative Medora's bill, and Representative Walker will be moving it for us.
Maybe I could have a little bit more burst of energy so I can ask like Representative Medora as major. You know, I'm always passionate, but, you know, Shelley gives it a little bit more oomph. For those of you that don't know, Representative Medora is still out ill, and so I have agreed to move her bill for her. And so, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3576 and have it referred and recommended to be moved to Health and Human Services Policy.
All right. Would you like to introduce the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have a testifier because it's not my bill. I do know the issue, but to make sure that I don't mess Representative Medora's bill up, we do have a testifier. I would like to say this is not going to be as an easier issue as the bill before, but it is something that I think that we should have a good discussion on and look at.
This is Roberta Opine. Is that correct? Thank you, Ms. Opine. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roberta Opine. I'm the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. And this year marks our 20th year of operation in the role of the Ombudsman, that the agencies existed as a separate independent agency. Ombudsmen are often referred to as the protector of the citizen in the government system. The agency was founded in part to replace the court monitor out of a class action lawsuit against the state in the 80s that was settled in the 80s, known as the Welsh Consent Decree. We were intended to monitor the mental health, developmental disability, chemical dependency, and emotional disturbance systems of state government. We are not a regulatory agency, and as a result, we have broad access to data related to these vulnerable citizens in Minnesota who are receiving services for these disabilities. Our number one priority that the legislature outlined for us and when our agency was created, to review the deaths and serious injuries of individuals receiving services in the system. Sort of our second priority in the agency is we receive and review complaints to ensure that clients' rights are protected and that the systems operate in the way that the legislature intended them on behalf of the citizens of Minnesota. When it does not, the Ombudsman may write reports and make recommendations on how to improve either practice in individual cases or systemic practice. And we also run the Civil Commitment Training and Resource Center to ensure that persons involved with the system, whether they be providers, lawyers, judges, doctors, nurses, social workers, can receive training on how the system is set up, how it's supposed to operate. House File 3576 is intended to be a clarifier bill that ensures current practice continues as it has for 20 years. And so I would like to emphasize that we're attempting to clarify the language and that nothing in this bill fundamentally alters any practice that hasn't been operational for the past 20 years. Recently, however, a question has arisen about whether or not the law needs to stipulate that the word copies is in there in order for us to receive copies. Now, as a state agency, we are required to keep records of what we base our decisions upon, how we come to our conclusions and recommendations. This is especially true for our death review process, but also for our individual case review process. In order to do that, we have to have access and sometimes the copies of those records. And our staff, we have 17 staff who could be called upon at any given time to go into over 12,000 facilities within the state of Minnesota. and various programs that we would have the oversight over. So as you can see, to be practical and pragmatic, the ability to retrieve the copy and study it versus driving to and from the programs to review the documents is critical. Without the access to copies, that would make our job fundamentally impossible, or pragmatically grind it to a halt. Item number two that's listed is to clarify that we can get the copy. All of the rest of the language in the bill is designed to cross-reference, again, things that have changed since that time, but that really have not fundamentally affected us, but they give clarification and comfort language to facilities. They make it easier to understand our access, given all the new laws, including HIPAA and the others. In subdivision 1E, we added the comfort language, which, again, already exists elsewhere in law, but that clarifies that we have to keep the data in the same classification that it's in, so that it spells out what our requirements are before we could re-release any sort of documents. We have to keep them in the same classification that they were under. Again, we don't anticipate any cost to this bill. We don't envision any expansion of the powers. We simply think it needs to be clarified in order to be sure that we can continue to function in the way that we've functioned in the last 20 years. With that, I guess I would stand for questions. We did a handout. I know you have the bill summary. We did a handout that clarifies what we're doing. It also provides you on the back with the cross-references to the statute. And if you want, I'll go through. The first item is to clarify that deceased person who's been a client remains a client. We can't do our death reviews if we can't have access to the information on the decedents. And that's the number one priority sent out to the legislature. So when it says we have access on behalf of clients, the law is very specific that no release is needed for us to conduct our death review process, because it is a statutory oversight role. The second item, subdivision 5, 245.91, subdivision 5 clarifies that gather includes receiving copies of information. 245.94, subdivision 1C references that the federal law that's referred to as under the HIPAA Act as a health oversight organization, which has never really been a problem, but it just helps to cross-reference and bring our legislation up to date. Again, as I indicated, the next provision stipulates that we have to keep the data in the same classification it was, whether it be under Chapter 13 or the Medical Records Act or any other state or federal law. The only provision that is somewhat different, we have always had subpoena power. That's been fundamentally... It's just that without adding the words Ramsey County, it would mean the AG might have to drive to 87 different counties. Other state agencies that have subpoena power simply do it in Ramsey County with the AG's office. So this was a suggestion of the Department of Administration Information Policy Office to make it consistent with other agencies. Then again, it subdivision 2A of 245.94 simply makes a cross-reference to the fact that a duly authorized state agency that has death review obligations can get the identifying information on people who were receiving services and died while receiving services for chemical dependency. And then the last provision simply... adds clarification comfort language. We do have a medical review subcommittee of our advisory committee. They are all appointed by the governor. They consist of psychiatrists, internal medicine doctors. We try to have a forensic pathologist We have a psychopharmacologist. We have nurse on our medical review committee. Most of our reports to them are written in a way that doesn't immediately identify. However, in some rare circumstances, in order to do their job, they might have to read a provision of a medical record. So this just simply clarifies that they're part of the function. They all sign privacy confidentiality agreements as part of their service on the Ombudsman Committee. So I guess with that, I would stand for any questions or clarifications.
Thank you, Ms. Open. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just got a couple. I mean, we spoke the other day, but
yes.
You know, I've seen a lot of people since then, and my mind got cluttered. permission to for these records. If someone is not deceased. Could you explain the? Can you obtain these records with or without permission? It talks about this in here. And then the second question: tell me again why you need the copy as opposed to taking notes on these records.
Ms.
You explain that once. I just want to hear it again.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlaw, members of the committees, I think those are all good questions. The law that governs our access to data, I mean our law that talks about what we have access to and what we don't, is very careful to spell out the levels of vulnerability. Because of the Wells Consent Decree, and that involved the Cambridge State Hospital, we clearly were given access to monitor services on behalf of developmentally disabled persons with or without signed consent. And this was because they are considered to be some of our most vulnerable. And in terms of those who have guardians or representatives, sometimes the issue is related to whether or not the checks and balances are in place, including work of the guardians. So we were given broad access to go in and look at those records. The reason that for mentally ill individuals or other individuals, we do obtain a signed release, but the law is very clear, unless they're not capable of giving us a signed release. Now, interestingly enough, nowhere else in law do we define the word capable. But generally, that's considered competent, but not necessarily in the means of the court competency. It's perhaps they're delusional at the time, or if someone says, well, that person signed your release, but, you know, we don't think they're capable of signing the release, then the law makes it very clear that we don't need it. That way, someone can't use that as a provision to sort of hide behind not allowing us to look into the facility. I will tell you that in the 20 years that we have been in existence, I am not aware, as the ombudsman, and I've been there for 15 years, of any client of the agency who were designed to protect or any family filing a complaint with our office that we've ever abused that. We don't have enough staff to be out looking for issues that don't exist. Our staff always have some sort of reasonable cause to believe, either by reports from clients, family members, staff, that there's a problem. So we're very judicious. We just don't even have the staff or resources for the witch hunt. The reason we need the copies rather than notes is because the state law requires us to keep the evidence upon which we base our decisions. Now, with 17 people conducting these death reviews, I'll give you an example. We have staff based all over the state, but the medical reviewer is based out of Anoka. The medical reviewer, for the very serious cases, has to go out and review the records and decide which ones we might need copies of. We often will look at copies, even if we just took notes. But then it might be the notes at the facility. Then we might look at the hospital record. Then we might look at the county social service record. We need to keep those as cross-references in case there's any discrepancies. But in addition, if we look at the facility record, then we look at the hospital record, it might spur a new question on the facility record, and then we have people driving all over. The drive up to a remote part of the state might be 3 to 4 hours up there, 3 to 4 hours back. That's time that the worker can't do their job except driving, and it doesn't make a lot of sense, but we're also required to keep the evidence.
Okay. Representative Wardlow, does that address your concerns?
Yes, I thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Olson. Yes, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. Do members of the family, guardian, those who have a legal connection with the deceased, do they have access to the same information that you would have now under this bill?
Ms. Olpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, and members of the committee, I believe that the access to records from next of kin on a decedent may be spelled out in Chapter 13, I'm not sure. But they would have access, we might have access to something that might be private or confidential that they don't, I just don't know the Data Practices Act. They do have access to our death review process. The purpose of our death review process is primarily forward-looking. Were there system gaps? Was there something missed? Could we make recommendations for the future? We don't do it immediately, and we're not law enforcement, so we prefer not to bug them 6 months, 12 months out, excuse me. And but they are supposed to be handed by all the facilities and programs a letter from us that states a report's been made to our agency. They have a right to know the outcome. And they can contact us if they want it.
Yeah. I believe Representative Walker has a contribution here. So
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, I think the other important piece, we have so many individuals, whether they're deceased or have a situation while they're still alive, that don't legally have a representative, that they either have themselves or that they have community members, but legally, their parents may have passed. They may have not have ever had a guardianship hearing and things of that nature. And so how do these individuals who don't have legal a legal representative have access to the records also?
Thank you, Representative Walker. Representative Lanning.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The family members, to the extent there are family or guardian, I understand that some people don't have. Do they have access, complete access, to all of your findings and your records that you have gathered with regard to a death?
Ms. Olpin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Lanning, they would have access to those documents that were not... they have access to certainly our reports, our findings, and any records that are classified that would be accessible to them. In other words, if next of kin can receive private data like a medical record, if there's something in the record that is classified as confidential, meaning even the subject of the data cannot have it, then we'd have to keep it in that classification.
Representative Lanning, does that...
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my concern here is I understand the arguments for your wanting to guarantee that you have access to the information you need to do your work. I have a little bit of a concern where you have that access, you're given that access, and yet family members or guardians may not have. And I think as we look at this issue... we've got to make sure there's some balance here, that you are given the tools you need, but families are also given the tools they may need to pursue a possibility of a wrongful death or whatever the case might be.
No, we do have some other testimony from the department, so on the other side.
Okay. I'm wondering if the department has testimony to give in this regard that might help with some of these issues and concerns. That's Ann Berry. Welcome to the committee, and if you identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Berry, and I'm the Chief Compliance Officer with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'll do what I can to assist you with some of your questions around the Data Practices Act, but I'm here today actually to speak against one section of this bill, and that is the definition of the term gather. We've had this discussion with the Ombudsman. One of our concerns is around the receiving copies of data, and that is the presumption that those are hard copies of the data. One of the things that we try to do inside the agency is to clean up that process so that we don't have patient files, that we don't have information about our clients in paper files moving from our facilities into somebody's car and back to an office. So what we have offered to the Ombudsman is a technological way to fix this, that we would encrypt those files, send them to them, and they would have access to them. So if they needed them for their reports or if they needed them for future work, they would have access to them, but that the file themselves would not be moving around. And we know that if there are going to be breaches of information, it's generally because somebody made a copy and it was stolen or lost. And we're working very hard to avoid that from happening. As you know, this is, in most cases, very sensitive personal information about people and their family. So it may feel or seem a minor issue to people, but we're working really hard inside the agency to make sure we secure the data that is supposed to be private. So we are asking that the language that specifically requires us to provide copies not be included in the language.
Ms. Oppheim, are you amenable to this amendment, and does it address your concerns?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Ombudsman would oppose that amendment for one simple reason. Ms. Berry is absolutely correct. We've been working together, and, you know, there are times when the agencies work well together, and then there are other times because of the dynamic tension that the role of the Ombudsman plays is important. We are working with them to try to work out a system with electronic access. The reason that we oppose the specific provision is, number one, if the department's interpretation that because the law doesn't say the word copies, that we can't receive copies, prevails, then that issue is true for every single provider, and we can't have 12,000 different manners in which we access data. If we can set up a workable system with the department and do it that way, we're not unamenable to that, but we still need the language copies in there in order to do the rest of our work, the other 11,000 some facilities. Secondly, we're just unsure whether or not that's going to work on a number of levels that still, we're just working to set that up, and sometime in the next couple of weeks we'll be testing it out. But there is a couple of concerns that we have yet to iron out and get clarification on. One is that they would retain it in what they call an electronic parking lot. That means the Ombudsman has no control over whether or not it's retained or modified. They've agreed to retain the data for the period of our data retention requirements in that parking lot, but the reality is we have no control over that, and just as we can make mistakes or anyone can make mistakes, the department and the staff there can make mistakes, and of course the legislative auditor, from our own experience when the Ombudsman for Crime Victims was transferred to us but not the budget, we got hit with a number of citations from the legislative auditor because of things that were done wrong in that program, even though we weren't even allowed to look at, touch, or access the budget of that program. So we have that concern to work out. We also have the fact that sometimes we are talking about hundreds of pages of records, and I don't know how my staff is going to respond to that. It's pretty hard to read those number of pages of records and skim through them on a digital basis. And so those are the kinds of things where we need to do cost comparisons. That's why we oppose it. It's not that we aren't willing to work with the department on this.
Ms. Berry, if you'd like to continue your testimony, I'm sorry if I didn't give you a chance to fully set your...
Madam Chair, that was the only concern was the use of the term receive copies of the data.
All right. Are there questions for either of our witnesses here today? Yes, Representative Walker.
You know, thanks, Madam Chair. Actually, I have one for Ms. Berry. I'm curious to know if there is a legal proceeding and it's court ordered that you hand over the information, how you handle that.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes. Mm-hmm. If we are court ordered to turn over what is otherwise private information, not just to the Ombudsman, but in a number of proceedings, we do turn over that information. They often go with protective orders to the court.
Thank you. Madam Chair,
yes,
remember, and I think that's the piece, because, you know, a lot of members, including myself, still don't understand the function of why we have ombudsman offices in the first place, and what by statute they have rights over, what they govern, what they're supposed to be looking at. And while it may not be a court order procedure, it is part of statute that these individuals, not looking at a legal proceeding, not trying to start the civil suit, may end up in a criminal suit in the end. But they are here to protect and to make sure that the processes of government was done properly for each individual, especially our most vulnerable individuals. We do have other offices. For example, I work closely with the Ombudsman for Families that deals with out-of-home placement. And while we have started the HIPAA and more privacy and looking at how we handle data, that should not stop an agency from being able to do the functions of the statute that we designed. Now, if it's something that the body wants to come back and look at the functions of what these different ombudsman's offices are supposed to govern, that's one thing. But to cripple them, or not cripple, but to hinder them in doing the functions that we have in statute, I think is also a disservice.
Are there further questions? Yes, Representative McFarland.
My question is, if they are to receive information electronically, are they able to print that?
Madam Chair, Representative, the way we had set it up is that they would not be able to download and print it, but we have had the conversation that, in fact, they could download and print it, and it would be at their, I guess they would be the ones then that would be held responsible if something happened to the data. Our biggest concern is in fact, turning over that information at the facility. We have 200 facilities around the state. It'd be turned over. You know, obviously there's travel between the facility and their return back to their offices. So we think there's less of a risk associated with in their own offices downloading that information and printing it in their offices.
Representative Walker?
I just was going to say, Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, the piece that, because you had another meeting that you had to go to, so you weren't able to hear the beginning of this testimony, was that this office has been established for 20 years. Prior to the Privacy Act, has never had a complaint. And the thing is, if you're supposed to keep the copies, how are you going to go back to reference? And I think the part that Ms. Opine said, importantly, for those of us that are always, I won't say conspiracists, but suspicious of government functioning, period, being able to have the papers sometimes does a lot more easing of the mind than having it altered or a possibility of it being altered. And we only need one individual case or one situation or one individual. Thankfully, thus far, I've never heard of that happening, but we only need one to change that system completely. And so just to prevent it, to be safe, I don't think there's anything wrong with having some paper. If they're going to pay for it.
Excuse me.
If they're going to pay for it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are not unmindful of the department's position because we're all prone. I mean, I can have a car accident on the way home and, you know, pieces of my car could be spread all over the place. We understand that, and we certainly have some procedures within our agency. I will tell you, Representative Walker and members of the committee, we have had cases where we got a copy of the record and then later discovered that the record had indeed been altered. I'm not attributing that to the Department of Human Services, so please don't misunderstand that. But I'm talking about the global responsibility that we have and where our records were, in fact, shown as evidence of alteration of records. So I think that you know, the point that Representative Walker makes, we want to work with the department. I would be horrified and lose many nights of sleep if we were the cause of re-release of inappropriate data that wasn't lawfully obtained. Many times we would like to even see some of our records protected even more, not so families couldn't get them, but in many respects we don't believe we're supposed to be the investigative arm for civil attorneys and some of that, or psychopathic personalities who want to call us into court to testify. But that's a separate matter. This is just simply about how do we pragmatically get our job done. Regardless of the decision of the committee, we will give assurances that we'll continue to work with the department to make sure their concerns get addressed.
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't aware that you... I thought you couldn't print them. And now that the department says you could download and print them, that seems to be comfort level. Maybe the wording could be changed so that you're allowed to print them rather than copies. I'm just trying to find some compromise.
Madam Representative Wardlaw,
thank you for compromise. To me, face value sounds really easy. But then here, let me ask you this. If you have a situation where you filled out a form, whatever it is, and then you have someone in the department that has inputted that form into the computer, now the information, instead of the form that might have said had a special dietary reaction to whatever, that person that was inputting it into the computer might have not put that on there. That might have had a reaction to some medication or whatever. It didn't get put in there for whatever reason. It was overlooked. And so now the information that you have is just the material that was put in the computer. You no longer have what was put on the form.
Representative Rood, did you? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, can you not have, we have at our clinic scan documents, so if the actual document is scanned in, and so it's not a human inputting the information.
Madam Chair, that was going to be what we do is we scan, we image all of these files. In fact, we've begun a process of imaging all of the department's files. So what we would do is we would image that client's file. Everything that was requested by the Ombudsman Office would be put into that image and then sent to them in their offices so that they would have access to it wherever they are doing their work.
But then Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess then my only thing would be, what is the difference then? If you're saying that they'll have full access to what's in the file electronically because they'll be able to print it, why can't they just take the time to copy the folder?
Ms. Berry.
Madam Chair and Representative, they would still have to image or copy the file. It may seem like a very small concern, but walking away from a facility with a paper document is a risk. There is a risk associated with clients' medical files, their mental health history, their chemical health history, not just in the work that the Ombudsman does, but in other investigations that take place. We have moved away from giving people paper copies because the opportunity, the risk of breach of that information is high, and we don't want it to happen. We're trying to avoid it from happening. If we can use technology to avoid it, we will.
Madam
Chair. Ms. Goldman? Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, I get that piece of it, but they're not getting the information. I mean, that's the piece here. That it'd be one thing if they weren't ever going to get what's in the folder, but you're saying now that there's a way for them to get what's in the folder. Walking away physically from a building doesn't stop them from getting the information. They're going to have access to the information. And so, we're doing oranges and apples here because they're getting the information. Now it's the method of the information, and if you're saying that the entity would prefer to make their copies instead of relying on the department scanning in for the same information, I'm not getting something here. I'm having difficulty, and I think it's also important, members, if you haven't seen your information, Ann Henry from the Disability Law Center also supports the bill.
Ms. Alpine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me kind of do what our men do and kind of broker in between this somewhere. If we can work out with the department on a pragmatic operational basis, the fact that they can print off, that we can actually print those copies in our office, that deals with the issue of the department. The reason we're here is, as you know, some of the facilities we go into are 3- and 4-bed group homes. They don't have scannable documents and records, and we just we need that language in there to make it clear that we can get those copies. Now, if to provide comfort to the department, we can work out a deal where we have absolute assurances that we are getting everything we need, that it's not been altered, and that we can print it off in the privacy of the office so that it's not being carded. We're willing to do that, but I don't think we can have one law that applies only to DHS and another law that applies to the other 11,800 facilities.
Representative Walker?
No, just okay. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Okay. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Anyone who has worked with records management understands that the department has a legitimate concern here about what happens with files when they're given out from a department and somebody is able to carry them somewhere else. And it seems to me that the department has, I think, made a reasonable request here that would still provide the information that you need and avoid the risk that you have with files being improperly distributed. You just don't have control. Anybody who's ever been in charge of administering files, like I have, understands the problem.
Representative Lanning, it sounds to me that there's some agreement that specific agreement with the department could be made, but the need for the broader legislation that encompasses other entities is still necessary. So I don't know if we'd be asking for, obviously it would be helpful if the two of you would continue to work together, but the question is then in the department's eyes, is this wording appropriate if you reach an accommodation? Ms. Opheim, do you want to comment first, or should Ms. Berry comment on that?
Well, I wanted to make one comment first, and then I certainly... I've known Ann for 15 years, and we've worked together on a number of things. The one thing I wanted to comment on is we absolutely agree that it is a risk and there is a fundamental issue out there. But again, I would like to stress that the agency has been receiving hard copies that we walk out to the car with, and again, never been accused of losing a document or anyone falling into the hands of anyone that wasn't in a lawful, straightforward manner. So this is a relatively new concern. We are more than willing to operate with compromise with the department so that we can do it electronically and print it off. We simply, however, can't have 12,000 different agreements in place. And that's the reason that what we can achieve in a compromise with the department may be different than what we actually need for the rest of our practice elsewhere.
And a question for Ms. Berry is that could the department conceive that their receive might mean electronic transfer in your case? I mean, the receive isn't defined in the legislation, so.
Madam Chair, if
Ms. Berry.
If you and others are comfortable that receiving copies would mean transmitting them electronically from us for them to print and use for their work, I was making the assumption that transmittal of hard copies to them. But if you read that or are suggesting that to be read, that we would transmit them to them electronically, then we would
see that. Well, no, I'm not saying legally what the definition of receivable, but as I'm hearing the discussion unfold, it's clear to me that if the needs of the Office of the Ombudsman is being met and they are indeed receiving the copies and able to, do what they need to do to get their work done, then the problem is solved.
Mm-hmm.
But Representative Wardlaw?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But what about those facilities that are so small they don't have the means to scan, and could there be an exception for them? Or I know you have a car accident on the way home, a three-hour drive, and the records are all over the place, maybe.
May I respond, Representative Wardlaw? I was not insinuating that electronic transmission would be the only way to receive, but it would be one way to receive. So in the smaller, with a smaller entity, copies would be, whether it's, Xerox or other forms of transmittal. As long as the ombudsman receives the copies they need to do, then I don't know if we have to delineate what receive means here. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But that would mean if they do have the means to scan, they could ignore it and just give them anyway. Is this department comfortable with that?
Ms. Berry.
We don't have responsibility for running all of those other facilities. We have responsibility for the 200 that we run. If I were a small facility, I would look for a way to scan and send that information in an encrypted way. It is not all that difficult with technology that exists today, and almost any application software, people can do that. We have the ability to do it and actually set up a server for that for the ombudsman that would be their own. And they would decide when, how long to keep those records. So we're in a position to make it easier to happen. I would suggest that for a facility that could, other facility, not state run, that could do that, they would want to do it the same way as well. Because we all have the same concern over client information and maintaining the privacy around that claim.
Representative Walker. Representative Wardlaw, did you have a follow-up?
As long as you two go forward to the next committee and work out some agreement, and then we'll put a smile on Representative Walker's face, I'm happy.
Representative Medore, Representative Walker.
Representative Walker,
Madam Chair, members, I think the other piece, I just want to make sure that we don't lose is the ones outside of the DHS. For those of you that don't know, I spent 6 years working in those 3- and 4-bed facilities that Ms. Obim is talking about, 17 of them. And from discretion of being able to write staff notes, to medical appointments, and the material you bring home from those medical appointments, the transferring of the information that you're supposed to do when you're talking to the nurse over the phone, it is very complicated. It's not as simple as you think. Legally, how we're trained, ethically, the things that we're supposed to put. I'm sorry to tell you that it doesn't always happen. We don't always put the information in the staff notes that we're supposed to. It may be because we just didn't give time because of a behavior. It may be because we ran out of time because of whatever. And so, unfortunately, we have great organizations out there, but you do leave it open for something not appropriate to happen when you're coming back in and filling in information. You're coming back in to right before you have to scan it in. And so I'm just getting to Representative Wardlow's thing of still the importance of still being able to access original documents. Once it's scanned, you can't tell necessarily if it was blue and black ink. But being able to see that day and being able to see the difference in writing really close up on a piece of paper that's original, trust me, you can. It's just one of those things of making sure that, again, the stress. The office is supposed to make sure that government runs well. And when it's not running well, that it's investigated and that we do something about it, especially for our most vulnerable individuals in the state.
Representative Ruth.
This is out of curiosity a question. I know we've had a lot of discussion about healthcare reform and trying to standardize systems and things like that. In this particular field, do you still rely mostly on handwritten notes? I know we do a lot of dictating. There are a lot of standardized electronic records where you just check off, and that does make it easier for quality comparison and things like that. I'm just curious where that world is at as far as that evolution is concerned.
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative. The question is relates to how far we're moving on the electronic records field, and I think your larger institutions like DHS and the major hospitals and major clinics are moving in that direction. But a huge share of our public philosophy surrounds the concept of people moving into 3, 4, 5-bed group homes. Many of those are mom and pop. They will the year on the horizon when that level of sophistication will be there will probably not be in my work life. And
mine.
And you're much younger than I am. I think that the state of the art right now is not anywhere near the sophistication. I would applaud that day. I would much rather sit in my office, call a band and say, we need Bob Smith's files because he had an injury, and get it via email or a server or a sign-in, whatever. As long as we can print it off for comparison, people now often handwrite out their reports. We ask them to fax them to us. We're perfectly comfortable getting faxes, but once in a while, the nature of the case does dictate you better go out there and you better look at the hard evidence. None of what Ms. Berry and I have been talking about is precluded by this legislation, and we no more want our name on the front page of the paper for an improper release of data than they do. She's right, we can make a mistake. We're right, they can make a mistake. This isn't about having cross purposes here. This is about how we can do it effectively, but we operate in more than one arena, and that's why we need to be able to cover those bases.
Right. Our committee time is up. I want to give Ms. Berry another chance to follow up there, because you looked like you had something you wanted to say.
Madam Chair, I simply was going to answer the question. We are moving to electronic health records for all of our clients in our Get Operated Services system, but we have a history of paper and handwritten notes and files that would need to be given and might take a long time. So anyone who has been with us a period of time whose record would be reviewed by the Ombudsman Office might be part electronic and part paper, so we have to accommodate both.
So it sounds like the department and the Ombudsman Office will continue to work together, and I'd like to ask Representative Walker to renew her motion.
Yes, Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File, what it run,
3576.
Thank you. We refer to Health and Human Services and recommend it to pass.
Okay. Representative Walker has renewed the motion that House File 3576 will pass to Health and Human Services Policy. All those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion is passed, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.